I could not find a good example of a case with diastolic murmur. In this case, the diastole is relatively silent. Systole, there is something that is abnormal. If you compare this with what we saw earlier, this is a normal case where systole and diastole are both silent. You have S1 and then S2 and nothing in between. Whereas now, there is one. In your lab exercises, I'll be giving you some signals like this. This is what we collected in Winnipeg when I was in Winnipeg several years ago from the Children's Hospital there. You'll be getting a few signals of this nature with three channels, the heart sound, the ECG, and the carotid pulse. So you'll be doing a lab exercise with these signals, detecting the QRS complex, and then segmenting the heart sound and doing some spectrum analysis. You can play the sound signals and listen to them, the normal and the abnormal, and then appreciate. I don't have an audio recording here, but you could do that on your own later on when you do the lab exercises. Any questions about the heart sounds? All the EEG, we didn't stop there. Okay, we'll continue on, and if you have questions, we can listen to them later on. The carotid pulse is another signal that is not very commonly used, but under certain specific conditions and when additional investigation is required into the cardiovascular system, then the carotid pulse could also be recorded. And the three-channel recordings I showed just now are from the Children's Hospital, where children with cardiovascular diseases were routinely examined using the three-channel system: heart sound, ECG, carotid pulse. So carotid pulse is a pressure signal recorded over the carotid artery as it passes near the surface of the body at the neck. And that's a good point to record because it's fairly close to the heart. The transmission delay and effects are minor. Whereas by the time the pulse comes to the wrist, it will be filtered and you will not be able to see the detailed characteristics. And also there will be effects of reflection of the pulse from the periphery, from the end of the arm, from the fingertips, for example. So a pulse at the wrist could be measured. You could also measure a pulse at the fingertip, but then you may not see the minor details that are of interest. Whereas here, you get a strong signal and it's close to the heart. The pulse signal indicates the variations in arterial blood pressure with each heartbeat. It resembles the pressure signal at the root of the aorta because it's very close. The transducer that we have used is this, an HP transducer with a bandwidth from 0 to about 100 hertz. When I say 0, it's a pressure signal, so it's not exactly 0, it will be 0.001 or something. But effectively down to 0. The carotid pulse, it rises abruptly with the ejection of blood from the left ventricle to the aorta. Of course, there is a similar ejection in the right side, but that from the right side, from the right ventricle to the pulmonary artery, and it goes to the heart. So you don't get an external pulse related to the right heart. So the carotid pulse is clearly related to the left ventricle. There are some parts of the carotid pulse, the peak called the percussion wave, the plateau or secondary tidal wave T, and this is caused by the reflected pulse returning from the upper body, and closure of the aortic valve. That causes a sudden termination of the movement of blood, and that causes what is called an incisura, or the notch, and that is called the diachronic notch. And then there is a diachronic wave that's a reflected pulse from the lower body. I'll go back and show you the carotid pulse. So here we have, soon after the contraction, this is where the ventricles contracted, but note that the carotid pulse is recorded a few centimeters away from the IoT plan from the hub. So there is a delay related to the transmission of the vibration pulse of blood from the left ventricle to the recording position. So it doesn't happen exactly here, but with the delay, with the contraction, you have an increase in the pressure. That's called the P wave. And then the T wave, which is related to reflection, and then the diatonic notch, which is when the aortic valve closes. The aortic valve closes at the end of the T wave, but there is a small delay because of the transmission from the ventricle to the recording site. And that relates to the beginning of S2, because the second sound is related to the closure of the aortic valve. But this is very specific. The diatonic notch is related to exactly that moment when the aortic valve closes. Now, when a patient undergoes cardiovascular surgery and is being monitored for recovery and other effects, there could be some pressure transducers and other transducers that are inserted into the heart through catheters. The catheter may be introduced through the femoral artery from the thigh and then brought to the heart. I'm not sure if they use the right or the left, perhaps the left. Right. And bring it into the through the aortic valve into the left ventricle. These sensors are placed at the tip of the catheter. And the catheter can be positioned, the sensor can be positioned within the cardiac chambers or just after the aortic valve if you want to record the activity of related to the aortic valve or the pressure gradient across the aortic valve. You cannot place it at the valve because the valve has to open and close, but it can be just after the aortic valve, or it could be inserted into the left ventricle. You can measure left ventricular pressure. You can measure right atrial pressure. You can measure the aortic pressure and intracardiac sounds. And of course, these are invasive because you're putting something into the patient and there are some risks. So you don't do it normally, but under certain conditions, when the patient is undergoing surgery and it is important to monitor these signals, then you would get into the invasive procedures. Now, these were recorded from a dog. Here you have the aortic pressure in millimeters of mercury. This is the left ventricular pressure, right ventricular pressure, and the ECG. So when the ventricles contract, the QRS complex, the right ventricular pressure increases, the left ventricular pressure increases, and there is ejection of blood and the aortic pressure increases. Then when contraction ends, there is a diatonic notch in the aortic pressure. There is a discontinuity. That indicates the end of systole. Note that the right ventricular pressure is between 5 and 25 millimeters of mercury, whereas the left ventricular pressure is between 10 and 110 millimeters of mercury. So when blood is ejected out, the ventricular pressure has to be above the pressure on the other side of the body, on the other side of the aortic valve, which is the rest of the body, the systemic pressure. So it is more than 100 millimeters of mercury at the peak. So here is an illustration of the effect of extrasystole or premature ventricular contractions in the dog that was induced in some manner. I'm not sure what they did. There are some procedures to induce such contractions. And there is a normal contraction here. This is, let's look at the left ventricular pressure. Normal contraction and the extrasystole causes an increase in pressure that is not the full pressure range. It does not go to the maximum extent of PT. The next one happens to go higher for some reason. And then there's another extrasystole that causes this. So there is no ejection of blood, it's just a wasted contraction. I inserted or included this example on the speech signal, which is a bit uncommon in books on biomedical signal analysis. The speech signal is not a diagnostic signal typically, although there are some applications in speech therapy, and the diagnosis of certain pathology, certain types of pathology related to the speech system. But commonly, it is a communication signal. Typically, you would not encounter this signal, but there are some interesting aspects related to signal processing that are best illustrated by the speech signal. So I would like to go through the speech signal fairly briefly. The speech signal is produced by transmitting puffs of air from the lung. As I'm talking, I'm pumping a lot of air out. And that is done by sending puffs of air from the lungs through the vocal tract. And these puffs of air are modulated and set into vibration. And that is what we perceive as speech, as a sound wave. The vocal tract as well as the nasal tract is used. Certain sounds such as M and N make use of the nasal tract, and there is sound coming through the nose also that will give the certain specific characteristics of these nasal sounds. The vocal tract starts at the vocal cords or glottis in the throat and ends at the lips or the nostrils. We have two paths. The shape of the vocal tract is varied to produce different types of sound units, which are known as phonemes. So when I want to say ah, I have to keep my vocal tract held in a certain position, and I have to send these puffs of air through the glottis, set the glottis into vibration, and then cause a certain fluctuation in the sound, leading to a quasi-periodic signal that will give you the sound ah. Or if I want to say E, then I have to change the shape of my mouth, and the sound, the puffs of air that are coming through the glottis will be modulated by the resonance characteristics of the vocal tract and will be filtered so as to create the sound that we recognize as E or ah or U. So these are some basic characteristics of speech formation. From a signal processing perspective, the vocal tract acts as a filter that modulates the spectral characteristics of these puffs of air coming out from the lungs. And depending upon the nature of the sound that we want to produce, the puffs of air could be quasi-periodic, almost in pulses, or it could be just a random signal. The system is dynamic and time variant. And it's important to recognize that, because if there is no change in the system, I'll be just producing the same sound continuously, and I could be just going ah, so on forever, and there is no information conveyed. So it is necessarily dynamic and non-stationary and time variant, which is what gives rise to the speech. So the filter and the speech signal have time-varying characteristics, and they are non-stationary. But this is a very important characteristic of the signal that we need to recognize. And so is the heart sound. So are most biomedical signals. They are non-stationary. Speech sounds are classified mainly as voiced sounds, unvoiced sounds, and plosive sounds. These are three main characteristics, main varieties. There are some subcategories, but we will not go into the details. Voice sounds involve participation of the glottis. When you say ah, if you put your finger here, you can sense that there is a vibration. Air is forced through the vocal cords held at a certain tension, and that sets the glottis into vibration. The result is a series of quasi-periodic pulses of air. And there is a certain pitch, an average pitch between these pulses, which is known as the pitch. And of course, we can change the pitch. I can say ah at a certain pitch, or I can say ah at another pitch. So in the case of the voice sounds, we have a quasi-periodic signal that could be modeled in a certain way. You have impulses. That are quasi-periodic. So I'm changing the interpulse interval on purpose. And of course, a physiological system cannot produce impulses. So instead, there will be pulses. There is some modulation. So these are the puffs of air coming out. And then these cause vibration at the glottis, and what you see, or what you hear, will be something like that, which is a quasi-periodic signal. The same thing appears, same basic pattern appears repeatedly, and that gives rise to the sounds that we know as the voice sounds, typically the vowels, that are A, E, U, and so on. So these are the voice sounds, and their characteristics are in this manner. The input to the vocal tract may be seen as an impulse train or a pulse train. Upon convolution with the impulse response of the vocal tract, and the vocal tract is held in a certain position, we get the voice sound that is desired. And a quasi-periodic signal is produced with a wave shape that is repeated. And that wave shape is different for the different sounds, such as A, E, U, and so on. So vowels are voice sounds, and the features of interest in the analysis of voiced sounds are the pitch and the resonance of form and frequencies of the vocal tracts. This is the pitch period. You may want to measure the pitch between individual pulses or on an average over a certain duration, and you say the average pitch period is so many milliseconds. Or you could take this, you could take one of these pulses, which is the impulse response of the vocal tract, approximately. Take the spectrum of this and analyze the peaks in the spectrum. There'll be multiple peaks. And these peaks, indicating concentration of energy in the frequency domain, are called the resonance or formant frequencies. And they relate to the shape of the vocal tract. So for the various voice sounds, we have different ratios of the formant frequencies. I'll come to the example a little later. Unvoiced sounds are known as fricatives, and they are produced by forcing a steady stream of air through a narrow opening or constriction, like a murmur, but we pause it. And the constriction is formed at a particular position in the vocal tract. And that causes a turbulent signal that looks like random noise. But it's not quite noise, it's filtered, so it has certain frequency characteristics. The input to the vocal tract is a broadband random signal. It's not pulsed, the glottis doesn't, but the vocal cords don't participate. But this broadband signal is filtered by the vocal tract. And examples of fricatives are S and F and Zh. So when you say S, you're making a narrow constriction at the front of the vocal tract. When you say F, you're making a constriction here. When you say Zh, it's a little further back. In all these cases, if you put your finger on your vocal tract, on your glottis, you will not feel any vibration, so there is no vibration here. Instead, a steady stream of air is pushed through a narrow constriction, causing high-frequency sound. So this is known as unvoiced sound, which is a filtered random signal. There is no periodicity. A basic task in speech signal processing is to separate the voiced sounds from the unvoiced sounds, and also identifying silent breaks in between. So voiced, unvoiced, silence, segmentation of the speech signal is a basic step. Fricatives are unvoiced, They do not involve any vibration of the vocal cords, and examples are S and S and Sh and J and F. And there's another type of sound which is important, and these are called plosives or stops, where there is complete closure of the vocal tract and a sudden release. So that's the P and T and K and D. So you close the vocal tract completely and suddenly release, and depending upon the position of this closure and how you release it, you get these sounds. So this causes a gap and then an impulsive signal. So here is an example of the word safety. So this is the S, this is A, and this is F, and there is a little gap, and then T, there's an impulse here, and this is the E. So we have two fricatives, S and F, and then two vowels, A and E. And then there is a closing T. If you have a microphone on your computer, I suggest you record a sound, a word that involves fricatives and vowels and plosives, and study the characteristics in detail. Zooming into this, this is the A sound, where you see quasi-periodic waveform like that. From here to here is 1 minute, this is another, this is another. And it repeats. There may not be a clear gap as I have shown schematically there, but this is the pitch period, about 0.05, 50 milliseconds or so. And this is the S sound, where there is no periodicity, it's an almost random signal. A little bit longer, and then we'll take a break at 10:45. Is that okay? The heart sound is a vibration signal. I put these signals in a different sequence. We first saw electrical signals, and then we saw sound signals. And let's look at a couple more. Speech is also a sound signal. Sound is vibration. It's just the frequency band that we would call sound that is audible to us. Subaudible sounds could be called vibrations. An interesting signal is the vibromyogram. It's not commonly studied. There are several studies in the scientific literature. The vibromyogram is a mechanical manifestation of contraction of skeletal muscle. So when we hold a muscle in a contracted state, there is vibration of the fibers, because when they twitch, when the individual muscle fibers contract at 20, 30 pulses a second, there is vibration. You don't feel it because it's of a very low frequency nature. But if you put a pressure transducer, you can record the vibration. And that is known as the vibromyogram or acoustic myogram. It accompanies the EMG. So on the same muscle, if you put electrodes, you get the electromyogram. If you put a vibration sensor, an accelerometer, you get the vibromyogram. So you may want to study both signals, and we did some studies where we recorded both simultaneously, and there are other studies that have done similar analysis, and you may find the vibromyogram more advantageous in certain cases or applications. The muscle sounds or vibrations are related to the change in dimensions, the contraction and relaxation of the constituent muscle fibers. And they can be recorded using contact microphones or accelerometers. The VMG frequency and intensity are related to and vary with the contraction level. And the VMG and EMG may be used simultaneously, or one may be substituted for the other in studies of neuromuscular control, muscle contraction in athletic training, and biofeedback. In some cases, it may be simpler to use the vibration signal than the EMG. And you can easily play these as sounds with some amplification and also some shifting of frequency. You can apply a frequency scaling and then create an audible sound. I should mention that the electromyogram, the EMG, is also sometimes played as sound. You record the EMG and put it into a speaker, and as you increase the contraction level, the characteristics of the signal will change and the frequency will change. So the EMG is also sometimes listened to by directly playing it through a speaker. The frequency range of the EMG is fairly low, not more than a couple of thousand hertz. So it is possible to play an EMG directly as sound. The vibro-arthrogram is another signal that we have been interested in. This is a recording from the knee joint, where in order to study pathology of the knee joint, we record the signal by placing vibration sensors around the knee joint, either on top of the patella or on the sides or further down on the tibia. And this is not a signal that is commonly studied. Doctors don't listen to your knees, but there are certain conditions that cause sounds in the joints, not only the knee, but also the hip and the shoulder joints, and also the temporomandibular joints. Normally, they are well lubricated and smooth surfaces that cause no sound, but under certain pathological conditions, they could cause sounds. And the knee joint is the largest articulation in the human body that's formed between the femur, the patella, and the tibia. And the knee joint has some very interesting characteristics. It has 0 degree extension to 135 degree flexion. So you can extend and flex to a range of about 135 degrees. 20 to 30 degree rotation of the flexed leg. I will try to do that. And there are some important features of the joint. You have a joint cavity, there is articular cartilage, there is a synovial membrane, and a fibrous capsule. A figure will come up soon. The knee is called a synovial joint. It contains this lubricating substance called the synovial fluid. The kneecap, or the patella, is a sesamoid bone due to its shape. It protects the joint and is aligned to slide in the groove known as the trochlea of the femur during leg movement. The knee joint is made up of three important components: the patellofemoral compartment, the lateral tibiofemoral compartment, and the medial tibiofemoral compartments. So you have the patellofemoral component here at the top, and then the lateral one and the medial one. The patellofemoral compartment is the part that we were interested in a particular study. It's a synovial gliding joint. The tibiofemoral is a synovial hinge joint. The anterior and posterior cruciate ligaments, as well as the lateral medial ligaments, bind the femur and the tibia together and give support to the knee joint. There are ligaments inside that hold the bones together so that when you move, the bones don't go apart. So these add strength to the joint and hold the bones together across the joint. So here is a schematic representation that I copied from an X-ray image of the knee joint. So you have the femur. This is a frontal view and a side view. This is the femur coming from here. And you have the tibia and the fibula, the lower leg bones. And this is the patella, the kneecap. There are menisci, these pads that protect the joint so that when the femur touches the tibia, there is the shock-absorbing pad in between. That is known as the meniscus. They look like this from a top, in a top view. There are pads that absorb shock. And the ends of the bone are covered in a smooth substance called the articular cartilage, so that when the patella slides in the groove of the femur or the tibia, then there is no friction there. There is a smooth surface that is lubricated, there is no friction, and there should be no sound. What else is there? The ligaments are shown here. The medial collateral ligament, the lateral collateral ligament, and the cruciate ligaments that bind the bones together. Okay. Now, in the case of ligament injury, in skiing, in skating, Calgary is known for winter sports, or in the case of football, it's quite common to have problems with the knee joint where a ligament is ruptured. If one of these ligaments is ruptured, then the knee joint becomes unstable, and certain parts may rub against certain other parts and cause loss of cartilage surfaces and then lead to more problems. Or there could be wearing down and shedding of the articular cartilage surface due to arthritis, and bone could be exposed. If bone is exposed, then bone rubs against bone, which is shown here schematically by a rough surface, then there will be some sounds caused and pain. And that causes further degeneration of the joint and leads to further problems. There could also be problems with the menisci, these pads. There could be tears. There could be rupture. And if there are ruptures, pieces of the menisci could come in between the bones that participate in this articulation, and they could cause additional sounds and pains, pain. So, loss of cartilage surface due to degeneration related to disease or injury could lead to sounds, and the same with damage of the meniscus. So articular cartilage covers the bones, ends of bones, and the wedge-shaped fibrocartilaginous surface, the menisci, could also cause problems if they are torn. Cartilage is vital because it protects the underlying bone during joint movement, and loss of cartilage leads to pain, decreased mobility, instability, and sounds or noise. We were interested in a particular type of disease called chondromalacia patella, where the cartilage of the patella is lost. The articular cartilage softens, fibrillates, and sheds off the mid-surface of the patella, and the meniscofibrocartilage could also soften and relate or lead to degenerative tears. So these cause some knee joint sounds, and there are a few studies in the literature. Recently I wrote a review paper on this topic, which should come out in a couple of months. We also have published a few papers on this topic. There are not many papers, but there is some interest in some fields among orthopedic surgeons to study various means of assessment of joint function rather than arthroscopy, which is a semi-invasive procedure of imaging the surfaces of the bones across the joint. So the noise associated with degeneration of knee joint surfaces is what we are interested in, and VAG, the vibro-arthrographic signal, is vibration during joint movement by just swinging the leg. So we ask the subject to sit on a table and swing the leg slowly over a period of 4 seconds per cycle, and we record the sounds. Normal joints are smooth and produce little or no sound. Sometimes there will be some clicks, but they are not pathological. There are sounds, joint sounds affected by arthritis and degenerative diseases. Cartilage loss leads to grinding sounds, and detection of knee joint problems via the analysis of WAG signals is what we have studied to some extent, and that could avoid exploratory surgery and assist in diagnosis or follow up after surgery. To show you the joint, the common procedure that is used to explore and examine a joint surface, here are some examples from what is called arthroscopy. This comes later on in chapter 7 or 8. In arthroscopy, small incisions are made on either side, and a fiber optic scope is inserted. And some of the small surgical tools can also be inserted. and the joint surfaces are viewed using the scope. Here is a picture of the joint surfaces of the patellofemoral joint, the joint between the patella and the femur. And here, this is a normal condition where the surface is smooth. And these three cases indicate some damage and some shedding of the articular cartilage. This is known as chondromalacia. This is grade 2, and this is grade 3, and this is grade 4, where the degeneration is at increasing levels. Some cartilage surface is lost here. There are some parts being shedded here. These are different patients. And here, bone is exposed. It's a bit difficult to see this, but an orthopedic surgeon, when conducting arthroscopy, can see the details better and recognize the difference between smooth surface and bone exposed. So that's what it looks like. And arthroscopy is considered to be semi-invasive and not too risky, but there is always a certain risk of causing infection and other problems. There is a certain cost associated and a certain recovery period because there are incisions made. It is a surgical procedure. And my colleagues in sport medicine and surgery have indicated that several patients come with complaints of the knee joint and they end up undergoing arthroscopy, but later on find that the knee joint is perfectly clean. Although there was some complaint, there was nothing wrong with the knee joint. So the reason that we studied the VAG signal was to evaluate the possibility of detecting the joint problem, the presence of a joint problem in terms of cartilage surface damage or meniscal damage by just recording the sound or vibration signal rather than arthroscopy. If analysis of the VAG signal can prevent unnecessary arthroscopy and screen patients before arthroscopy and figure out which patients would benefit from arthroscopy and which patients do not need arthroscopy, then we could save some cost and pain to the patient. So that is the application that we are interested in. But we haven't done much over the past few years because of lack of funding. But we have published a few papers indicating where these signals could possibly assist. There is another acoustic signal that's been studied to a certain extent, not very common, known as the autoacoustic emission signal. The autoacoustic emission signal is the acoustic energy that is emitted by the cochlea, either spontaneously or in response to a stimulus. Normally, the cochlea is seen as a receptor, a transducer that receives signal from the outside and then sends the result to the brain. But it also generates energy, spontaneously in some cases, but in response to a stimulus, you can then elicit a certain response. There is a team at the University of Toronto, and there are other teams that have studied this signal, and it may assist in the screening of hearing function and diagnosis of hearing impairment, where you apply a stimulus and then record the response of the cochlea after, in the absence of anything else. We will not be looking at this signal. I just wanted to mention that. All right, before we take up signal processing, I would like to go through a few objectives of biomedical signal analysis and a few important points as to why we want to do this. But before that, let's take a break. It's an hour and 45 minutes since we started. So we'll break now for 15 minutes.